latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, hosted by data protection people. My name is Ollie Rear, and I am joined once again by my colleague, Mr. David Holmes, and producer Miles for this intro. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Ollie.
How are we on this, well, actually not so fine Friday afternoon, it's a bit miserable out, but how are we nonetheless?
Yeah, not doing too bad for Friday, but all good otherwise.
I definitely can't complain, Ollie. And it seems like another good session today.
Another good session. Yeah, I was going to say, don't sound too excited, Dave. Whatever you do. another good episode in the bank. Very enjoyable that one. But also, in one very specific way, quite a sad episode this week for me personally, because unfortunately, this is my last ever episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. I am sad to be leaving DPP this week, today in fact. This is my last day. We thought we'd keep it to the very end to announce on the podcast because we didn't want to cause too much of a stir. But unfortunately this is my very last episode, at least for the foreseeable. You know, you never know, might come back as a guest in future. But we thought we'd get that out of the way early doors, and it'll make sense for you listening to the rest of the episode, I think.
No, for sure. And we wish you well on your way with that. And it's probably why I'm not necessarily feeling so enthusiastic. But that aside, I thought it was a great chat. I thought there was quite a lot of different areas today. There's normally kind of sometimes themes running through them, but we kind of jumped around a lot, starting with kind of looking at a little bit of political bashing around the what's happening politics recently with emails going astray through to neurotechnology, didn't we?
Yes, well, I'd argue that was a vintage episode because there was Dave Soapbox. You had a good old rant about the state of UK politics, which is standard for us at this rate. We also spoke about, as you say, neuroscience. We spoke about the new executive order governing transatlantic data transfers. We spoke about TikTok. Loads of stuff. Things we've covered before, things we've not covered before. So yeah, really, as you say, pretty much vintage DPP, chat on this one, I'd say. Good episode, plenty of good interaction once again, and thoroughly enjoyable.
And I think we will try to maintain the momentum going forward. Unfortunately, the success of the series has been down to Ollie predominantly, and I apologise for any minor dip that we might get as it smoothly hands over to ourselves to run in Ollie's absence. But I'm sure he'll still keenly listen in either live or through the podcast series to keep us on track a little bit, eh?
I don't think that is fair at all. I think far more of it is down to you, Dave, than you're giving yourself credit for. And also, because I didn't shout out on a live session, but I think it's worth doing, so much of this is down to our very own producer, Miles, who, sets this up every week, edits them, puts them out, has a mad rush on a Friday. He's always so stressed on a Friday, poor lad. I think it's worth giving him a shout out. Thanks, producer Miles, for all your efforts on this. They're very much appreciated. And,
yeah, second that.
I like to think that the audience know that.
I do appreciate that. Well, it's like you say, I think it's a combination of Dave's wisdom, me obviously assembling the sessions, but I think Dave is right that it does center around you as the ringmaster. Sort of holding back chaos on most occasions.
Ringmaster of this complete circus, is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, it's exactly what I'm trying to say. So hopefully we don't descend into total anarchy when you depart. No, it's quite cheeky of you to think that you're going to escape us forever. So I'm sure we'll see you as a guest contributor in the very near future.
I would have said regular guest contributor at least once a week.
I'll do my best. I might have to clear it with my new boss, but we'll see what happens. But yeah, thank you Miles for all your efforts, and thank you Dave, because as I say, none of this would be possible without you either. You're here with me more or less every week and more or less on time. We actually did pretty well this week, but it simply wouldn't be the same without you and your trusty soapbox that you put to good use again today, I think is fair to say.
Yeah, had its dusting, for sure.
Yeah, it's dusting. Well, without wanting this to become sort of the farewell tour, I think we can probably leave it there. But yeah, as I say, thank you to you both, chaps. Thank you to all of our fabulous guests that we've had over the last almost 100 episodes or so. You know, we're creeping up to a century. It's a shame I wasn't able to see it out, but that's the nature of these things. So thank you to all of them. We've got plenty more fabulous guests on the way. Don't you worry about that. If you want to find out what's coming up, head over to the DPP website. It's all over there on the events page, or keep an eye on our social media. Miles regularly pushes out updates with all upcoming events. There's plenty in store. However, there are still gaps. So if there's anything you want to see, do let us know. You know, reach out if there's a specific topic. We had vexatious requests and individuals the other week, which was a listener suggestion, and went down really well. So, you know, if there's anything you want to hear, just let us know, please do. Without further ado, I think there's only one more group I need to thank before we let you get in, which is you, the listeners, our community. You know, it's quite extraordinary just how much it has grown over the last, 2 years we've been doing this, something like that. We worked out that we've seen, 3 prime ministers in that time, but I'll leave you to listen to the main body of the episode where we talk about that. But it really is extraordinary. We're incredibly grateful to our community, which is, I can't even call it our not-so-little community anymore, because it's outright, you know, growing every single day. It's absolutely extraordinary, quite unbelievable, and we're extremely, extremely grateful, aren't we, gents?
Ever so much so, yeah, ever so much so. And it's I echo everything you said. So if there's bits you want us to talk about, you want to come on as a guest speaker, you want to take part, you've got to join in and interact with us. We do apologize for taking over at times, but Ollie does his best to police it, and if you need a kind of a backdoor entrance, then I would speak to producer Miles, and I'm sure he'll get you the necessary tickets to the front seat of the show.
Absolutely. And on that note, without further ado, I will leave you to this latest and, for me, last episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. Protection Made Easy podcast, hosted by Data Protection People. My name is Ollie Rear, and I'm joined once again by my colleague, Mr. David Holmes, to talk all things data protection, privacy, and the like. Dave, how are we doing?
I'm well, thank you. Yeah, not so bad. Yourself?
Well, I'm very well, thank you, but I'm a little bit sad this week because there's some news that I have to reveal to our audience, news that I've been sat on for a while, that you've been sat on for a while.
Is that which Boris is that back? Is
it? Boris is back, yeah, exactly. The PM's resigned, Boris is back. No, unfortunately, it's far, far more devastating than that, or maybe not, depends on how you look at things. But this will, unfortunately, be my last episode of the podcast this week. I will be leaving DPP this afternoon. So it's after almost 4 years and, well, as we just said, nearly 100 episodes of this podcast, it's unfortunately time for me to move on. But all the more reason to make it a good one today. Let's really knock this one out. But before we get into it, I just wanted to thank you, Dave, in particular, for all of your time, efforts, insights on this particular feed.
Leave that as time?
none of this would have been possible without you, because you know, you're very much the voice of this podcast. And you know, while we share the soapbox, I wouldn't have been able to do it without you. And also a big thank you to our community, which has grown quite extraordinarily since we started this. So I leave them all in your very capable hands henceforth, Dave. So you're all warned. Be on your best behavior.
it may take me a while, because it's been absolutely great working with Ollie on the podcast series, and it's scary to see how far we've probably got with it, coming up to nearly 100 episodes and that kind of thing. But likewise, I really couldn't have done it without you, Ollie, and I'm sure those who have listened in whilst you've been on holiday realize I can't do it without you. So anybody who's listening moving forward, it may take a little bit more input and a little bit more kind of professionalism from myself. So we'll see where it develops and we'll see where it goes. But anybody who wants to jump in and join and take over then I'd fully appreciate that. And I absolutely agree where you're coming from with that comment, Rob. It's more upsetting than when Ant and Dec fell out.
Well, you know, I'm confident that we've got plenty of budding young starlets waiting in the wings to take over my position. I won't name them because they're rolling their eyes at me already, because I'm sat in the office today. But there's plenty of people to keep this going alongside yourself, Dave, and still more events than ever. They continue to roll on out. A word on that sort of towards the end. We'll let you know what's coming up over the next few weeks. But this podcast will keep on rolling. But as I say, just wanted to get that out of the way, first things first. And thank you all very much for all your support thus far. So before this becomes some sort of weird farewell tour, let's actually get into our episode of GDPR Radio this week, Dave. Have you got anything to start us off? I know you've had a busy morning. I know you've been up against it this week. So I don't know if there's anything specifically you wanted to start with. If not, I've got bits and pieces, a collection of news items over the past couple of weeks that we can talk about.
The one I am aware of that I can kind of talk a little bit about, if we want to start with the executive order that Joe Biden's recently signed in order to help or potentially help, because it's transfers of data from the US to the EU and back, that kind of thing. And we'd I'm sure we've all been sat there at times thinking, how on earth are we going to possibly do this moving forward, since the case with Max Schrems. Now, as we know, the executive order was signed was about a week ago, a couple of weeks ago now, by Joe
Something
Biden
to that effect, yeah.
Yeah, by Joe Biden. And it's, I think, aren't they calling it like a privacy framework now? So it's, I thought it might come back as Privacy Shield 2, but it's, I think they're calling it a privacy framework that they're trying to implement. It will require, there's conversations, and I've heard things that it might not necessarily come into play for at least 6 months to 12 months, because it still has to go through the adequacy kind of arrangements and deemed to be adequate by the EU. But obviously, if the two parties are working together, you'd like to thought they'd have ironed out some of the wrinkles along the way with that one. But there are a couple of changes in there, aren't there? That this new kind of framework is introducing in order to kind of facilitate this the transfers to and from the EU, and in particular having this kind of opportunity to bring a complaint or bring an issue to the Data Protection Review Courts. Who are supposedly there to investigate and resolve complaints, that kind of thing. It's interesting to see see that development. It'd be certainly one to kind of follow through and see where we end up. Bearing in mind, it is only EU and US.
Just watch it there, Dave.
Sorry, mate. Bearing in mind, it is only an EU and US kind of setup. At the moment, it won't necessarily directly apply in the UK, although the UK are, as you'd expect, trying to pedal in the background a little bit to keep up with the changes and trying to have their own framework.
Dropped out again, Dave, I'm afraid.
Sorry, is it? Let me just try and move bits at this side. Is that better?
You're struggling a little bit. But yeah, a little bit better. But if I could just pick up on what you're saying and hoping that you're... your broadband stabilizes while I do. It is interesting because you're right. We're talking now not about a rebrand of Privacy Shield, which, you know, I think a lot of us sort of imagined it would be. And, you know, looking into it, as you correctly say, the term framework has been mandated around, which is interesting. And one of the main things, so you mentioned this establishment of a data protection review court and this idea that effectively people now abroad will be able to challenge the behavior of, so the likes of, you know, American surveillance agencies, which has been obviously the whole sort of crux of Schrems 2. But they're in theory going to be able to challenge that now through the use of this special advocate system, which kind of response to that need that we saw outlined by the European Commission in Schrems 2 as to or in response to Schrems 2 as to needing an ombudsman, right? Because that was one of the big things that was said, was that if people have their rights infringed, they don't have anyone to take that to. And in theory, that that would sort of meet that need. I think that's the idea behind it. Is that the way you read it?
It was, yeah. In that sense, be like I said, it'd be interesting to see, because if anybody's been through the pain of looking at the international debt transfer agreements or running through, as you're expected to do now, a transfer risk assessment, this would certainly help facilitate those organisations that may still have or are looking to appoint software developers or SaaS products or cloud hosted products, possibly that are hosted out of the US. So it may simplify things. The question I was going to raise, though, is, and it's all kind of relevant to this, is do you think there'll be another Schrems 3 as a consequence of that? Do you think Max is kind of looking at it and going, ooh, that was last year, I'll focus on something else? Or do you think he'll still look at it and see whether there's a Schrems 3 on its way?
I think there's absolutely no chance that he sits there and does nothing. Knowing what NOIB are like, yeah. I mean, the interesting thing being that some of the commentary around this, so I think when I read up, they were saying that at the minute, the sources out of Washington have to remain anonymous for some reason, some part of the process, I'm not entirely sure. But those sources apparently have been quietly confident that if this is challenged by someone in Europe, they say in inverted commas, which is I think probably not so subtle dig at Schrems and his outfit, they're confident it'll stand up to that, because they're saying that they've moved away, precisely as you said, moved away from sort of the slightly weak, flimsy assurance that things like Safe Harbor and Privacy Shield provided to an actual framework, and they feel that this will respond to the needs of you know, Europe, the European Commission on this issue. So, yeah, interesting. I think it will almost certainly be challenged. Whether it's successful, I don't know. We'll have to see. I don't have the details. But interesting to see nonetheless, isn't it? Because you're right. It's really sort of put us into quite a tricky position, this whole affair.
No, it has. And to be fair, I always had a bit of an issue with the Privacy Shield myself, because it kind of came across as a bit self-regulatory, wasn't it? Do you agree that you've got measures in place to address this? Yes, then fine. And there's a whole adequacy kind of built on the back of it. It just felt a little bit kind of loose to me. I don't know if you had the same feeling about Privacy Shield itself, just whilst we're on the matter.
Well, no, I think you're right. And it's interesting, because in that sense, you can almost tie it back to our topic of conversation last week. So for those of you who weren't able to join us last week, we spoke to Barry Moll about the Data Security and Protection Toolkit, which is, you know, this NHS and NHS provider component, which is effectively a self-assessment, right, Dave? It's an assurance tool, but it's self-assessed, it's self-regulated, broadly speaking. And there were sort of similar themes to come out of that, which is that it is an opportunity to take your privacy compliance management seriously and really use it as an asset, you know, push things through, etc. But if you're the type of organization that maybe has a slightly less or slightly more lackluster, shall we say, approach to this sort of thing, it really is sort of the tick box exercise, right? And there's not necessarily that oversight.
No, for sure, and that's one of the bits. Because at the end of the day, if you're a controller and you're sending the information through to the US, it comes back to. And I know we've looked at it previously, and it was certainly part of a conversation we had with Barry last week around, well, what do we mean by due diligence? Now you're just going to accept the fact that they're on Privacy Shield, and you should be able to, because technically, under Privacy Shield previously, it was approved by the EC, isn't it, as being adequate. So therefore, should you rely on it kind of blindly, or do you need to do additional measures? And you may have a little bit of a kind of a get out of jail card saying, well, look, you guys approved it. I'm just looking for an organisation that's on there, but we've never really stress tested the evidence that they're suggesting that they're relying on to demonstrate that they're compliant. So it's it all just kind of fell a bit loose. I get your point about whether this one will be challenged. No doubt it will be looked at, and if they can be challenged, they can be challenged. But I've certainly read kind of reports around it that they've tried to address the issues that arose in Schrems 2 within this kind of framework. So if there's, I guess it's going to be an assessment of whether those measures are adequate and whether the changes have caused any of the measures to be brought into challenge.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. Apologies, I had to mute myself just a second ago. There was a bit of a chuckle behind the scenes in the DPP office. This is interesting. I'm keen to hear the thoughts of our group on this. So it's become tradition in the DPP office to, shall we say, encourage new starts to comply with a clear screen policy, which is enforced because, of course, you know, practice as you preach, we all apply clear desk and screen policies. It's become a practice that should our new starts decide to not comply with that and perhaps potter off to the shops to buy their lunch and forget to lock their laptop, that maybe certain emails may get sent on their behalf. So young Kane has kindly agreed to buy us all a drink later tonight. Isn't that nice of him? Well done, Kane.
I took that as genuine.
Well, yeah, I think you should bank that for next time you're up, Dave. just a peek as to how we do things here at DPP behind the curtain. But yeah, no, that it is interesting, all of that, you know, about the executive. We'll have to see what comes of it. It's one of those things that, you know, we'll have to stay close to. Sort of in tandem with that, Dave, I wondered if we could talk about this for a second. Sort of the idea, and I don't know if you've seen this, but obviously, you know, the less said about what's happening in politics in this country at the minute, probably the better, because it's a bit of a
bit of political bashing.
Well, I know this is going to get you started, so I'm trying to ease you into it. I saw an interesting piece this week. Well, it's not actually that interesting, but I thought it was worth raising that. Joe brought this to me today, which is basically more statements out of, well, let's be honest, the latest, I don't want to use the word vapid, it's possibly a bit strong, but the latest head of the DCMS and their, you know, existing qualifications on the matter, shall we say, you know, making noise that they now need to get rid of the red tape of GDPR because it's blocking businesses, etc. And according to, I've completely forgotten her name now, whoever the head of the DCMS is at the minute, apologies, I've forgotten. Donnellan, that's right.
Donnellan, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Saying that, you know, we've got a shortage of electricians and plumbers in this country and GDPR is stopping them from doing their job properly because they're tied up in bureaucracy. Good Lord, give us a break. Christ, honestly, what nonsense. It's the same stuff we've been hearing from every head of the DCMS for the past, well, since Brexit, right? You know, we had it from Oliver Dowden. We had it. Yeah.
It's about time to change the record, I think, on that one.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's just absolute nonsense. You would have, at least if you're going to go online and you're going to start making comments, at least get your facts right. Otherwise, surely those who are voting you into power and those that are trying to keep you in power should be rather ashamed of the fact that you're spouting nonsense that doesn't make any sense to the GDPR. And quite frankly, you would have thought the shortage of individuals taking up plumbing roles and bits and pieces may well be down more to the government's restrictions on immigration as opposed to the GDPR having a bigger effect on that, quite frankly, in that sense. And again, without necessarily trying to look like I'm political bashing, but why not, since we're on the topic, that kind of thing.
Off you go.
The whole lot
I'll
rein
you in if I feel like I need to.
the whole lot is a flipping shambles, and it's really ironic that the party appears to be only good at arranging parties, quite frankly, and it's pardon that, but it's what I think is the fact that what we need less spin and we need less rubbish by the politicians and those in politics, and I think
he's
what we need
off
is
soapbox. No, he's back.
Sorry, and I think what we need is a degree more humility within politics, and people kind of not just saying what they think they can say at free will and then just spinning your way out of it and all that kind of thing. I think that the whole setup at the moment is just ridiculous.
Well, you know, people will know that I would tend to agree with you on all of this. I think the thing to me on this latest one, I don't want to spend too much time on it because it's just the same. You're right, it's the same broken record. It's not interesting at this point. We know it's nonsense. But the thing that really gets to me is, and I'm not specifically picking on Michelle Donnellan just because she's the current head of the DCMS, but it goes for every single person who's come out with this, because we've had three in the space of however many months. This is someone who has never served as a minister for more than a year and who has been in this post for 6 weeks, who is apparently claiming that she's got all the answers to get rid of GDPR and unblock business. At what point do you stop taking us for idiots? Because it's just nonsense, right? Like, you cannot possibly know. You don't have the experience. So you're right, Dave. At what point do you actually show a bit of humility and go, this is a complex issue, we're going to take our time over it? I get it. It's a high pressure scenario. It's a high pressure job. You're being asked to deliver results. But that shouldn't come at the cost of common sense, because whether we like it or not, the European model of privacy is currently the world leader. It's currently the champion. And even the Americans are starting to align to it. So if we're the ones who are going to say we're going to start backpedaling on this, it just doesn't make sense. I get it. Yes, fine. There are countries that have European adequacy that have different frameworks, New Zealand, you know, Japan, Canada, etc. But we've done so much work to get to where we are. Why do we need to backpedal? It's just, it's tiring, quite frankly. And as Brenda says quite rightly in the chat, and then staff believe it because, you know, it's come from the government. And, you know, now you've got DPOs and privacy leads up and down the country who have to defend themselves when they shouldn't have to. It's ludicrous.
And I would agree. And I think some of that is pushed by party politics.
Well, it is,
in the sense that they've got to show Brexit's worked. So beyond any form of using even an ounce of common sense, they've just got to show that Brexit worked, because we've got to give some effect to it in order to keep some side of either the party or society on board with what they're doing and all the rest of it. So common sense has gone out the window. They're just entertaining the audience that they need to keep entertained with, well, this has worked, hasn't it? And we can demonstrate it's worked, because if it doesn't work, then electricians can't work, because, you know what I mean? And all that. It's just absolute, not shameful nonsense. And what scares me is the fact that, and I absolutely get the point that Brenda made about staff actually believe it. But what scares me more is the fact that with such a complex topic, people and politicians are spouting absolute nonsense in that sense, and it's inaccurate. And there's a lot of, not just ourselves, but there's a lot of people out there that could give appropriate advice that they seem to fail to take into account. But this is just one element of it. So what other nonsense are they coming out with that doesn't make any sense, that's not had any kind of appropriate kind of advice or guidance around it, that they're still spouting out that people are believing? Because surely the ministers are the ones that should be in the know with all the opportunities to have with advisors and things. And it's just absolutely scary about this. It's just one issue of a wider range of issues of fake news and nonsense that you just spin your way out of.
Yeah, but I mean, to be fair, it's frustrating, but we should have seen this coming, because wasn't it Michael Gove during all of the Brexit vote stuff that said we've had enough of experts? Or does that predate that? It might not be directly attributed to him, but I distinctly remember there being a big hullabaloo about someone outright in
I think,
you know,
yeah,
the media,
I can't remember,
and politician saying we've had enough of experts. No, we haven't.
Well, I think what they're saying is ministers have had enough of experts, because the experts are actually saying what ministers are coming up with is rubbish.
Yeah.
So it's probably the ministers are getting fed up of experts, because they can't do what they want to do, which is just rubbish. Anyway, we could spend an hour just having a go. It is absolutely shameful what's going on. And it's quite frankly, I think what we need is politicians with a bit of humility. Politicians say, like you say, it's a complex issue. Politicians, wouldn't it make an absolute fresh change, wouldn't it? Just before we finish, wouldn't it make a really fresh change? If you ever watch when they're having an argument in Parliament and coming out with what they need to do, wouldn't it make a really good change if somebody on the opposition benches went, well, that's a good idea, regardless of who's in power, regardless of popular politics and which party that you might have swayed with? It's just the same. Somebody comes out with something in politics and the approach is, well, everybody's got to diss it. Wouldn't it be good if they actually said, well, we actually agree with that, we maybe want to support that a little bit, and can we not be involved in order to kind of make sure that it's kind of fully, you know what I mean, in that sense? But it all just seems to be just a load of flipping nonsense, and it's they've kind of gone has democracy, and it's just a country ruled by school kids.
Well, that was quite something.
Anyway, shall we get back to data protection?
Yeah, Mark's asked that I take your soapbox with me when I leave the building. I'll impound it. I'll take it with me.
A note to producer Miles, could we cut that bit before we stick it on the podcast? I don't want anybody from MI5's looking at me.
You're going to get a knock on the door.
Possibly.
But on a more sort of, you know, on a less tangential note, shall we say, again, Brenda's spot on, which is that it does a lot of damage to us in our roles and trying to implement best practice. She says, I was recently told that the government states we can share all data with anyone in the business because it's not covered by the DPA. But this is the type of thing precisely that, you know, if you're fighting a losing battle on this sort of thing, if you're the lone individual or one of the lone individuals, if there's sort of a handful of you in the business trying to do this and trying to educate people and change the culture, because we know that culture is the number one driver behind, you know, proper compliance efforts. And, you know, you're not only having to battle people's preconceived notions of what you're trying to do, but you're also trying to battle, you know, sort of a torrent of nonsense coming from the government. It's incredibly difficult. I don't want to stay on it for too long though, because you've had your soapbox. It's fitting that for my last episode I've allowed you this that outburst, because crikey Moses,
left me running for so long.
Yeah, you know, the worst part is I actually have another story about the government to bring up, but I think this one's possibly slightly less contentious, but I thought it was worth talking about, because now obviously we've seen all the turbulence, but one of the things that sort of really preempted this, or was part of it, was the resignation of the Home Secretary, which yes. I'm sure we all saw. But that was interesting for a number of reasons. I'm sure we're all aware. One of the things I wanted to raise is actually a point which those of you all know Tim Turner made via his DPO Daily. Tim, who I think may be coming on the podcast before the year is out, actually, as a guest. So stay tuned for that. I think that'd be a really good episode.
It will be.
He's a very knowledgeable chap and plenty of great insights. But one of the things that he pointed out in his post, and I thought was really interesting because I wanted to pick up on it for other reasons, is, so we all know that this resignation happened because effectively the excuse was made that she'd breached some type of ministerial code, I think, in respect of she'd shared an official document through her personal email address or something like that, and had then used that basically as an excuse to hand in a resignation and then get in some quite incredible digs at the Prime Minister. But it's interesting because this was sort of reported as, she was saying it was basically a data breach, or at least she was sort of talking about it as, you know, I've used my personal email address, this is improper, etc., I have to go. And Tim made the interesting point that actually, you know, we see more and more of this, you know, people using personal email addresses, people putting things in emails that they shouldn't, people putting things in Teams chats that they shouldn't. And it is a real issue. We see it more and more, particularly through our SAR Bureau and support desk, of people saying very silly things in emails or Teams chats or whatever that they really shouldn't, and then being all embarrassed when someone puts in a SAR and all of a sudden it's revealed. And again, one of Tim's points is that a lot of this was accelerated by the pandemic, because it sort of eroded those barriers that maybe we once had in terms of our ways of working. And I thought it was a really interesting point, because, you know, I mean I certainly agree with that. People increasingly, because we work remote now, use these methods of communication in increasingly less and less formal way. And, you know, the margin of error in that sense really thins. And the point I sort of wanted to bring into this, I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that, Dave, but the point I wanted to bring in, because I've got, as a final story for today, I wanted to talk about TikTok a little bit. But I always think that's interesting when you look at sort of those barriers becoming eroded through, you know, the proliferation of communication channels, because it's something which increasingly I think kids grow up with now, because they're sort of connected, they're on the internet all the time, et cetera, et cetera. I do think that's why initiatives like the Children's Code are really valuable from the ICO, because increasingly I think you do erode those barriers to, you know, communicating with people, and it puts people that you're more and more prone to saying or doing something silly out there on the internet. And you often hear people at the minute say, or you used to anyway a couple of years ago, say, oh, look what these kids are posting online, aren't they daft, x, y, z. But kids are no more daft than they used to be. It's just that it's all on the internet now, it's open for everyone to see, you know. Yeah, we all did things that were equally daft, but, you know, we were lucky that it didn't get posted everywhere. So I just thought, you know, there's a lot of themes in this, but as a sort of microcosm studying this, I thought was interesting. I don't know if you've got any thoughts is a bit of a broad topic, I appreciate, but
I get where you're coming from. We have spoken previously on some of the podcasts about normalizing behavior. And I guess that's kind of the essence of where Tim's going with some of it, and with the with your own comments around that as well, with it's kind of becoming normalized. So is it lax behavior, is it normalized behavior? in that sense, and individuals don't necessarily either understand, be aware, or care about the problems that may be caused in that sense, if you look at individuals in private capacities and things. But just kind of separating them slightly with the Home Secretary and in that sense with her emails and things going through private channels, it is not the first time the government's been caught for this kind of thing, and saying that it's not acceptable and they shouldn't be doing it. And there's all the host, I don't know if you remember conversations and bits in the news last time it happened around, it kind of is it potentially circumventing the ability to scrutinise and to hold politicians to account because they're not communicating through official channels, and if it's not through official channels and so on and so forth, is it going to necessarily be evident from a FOIA request and that kind of thing, you know what I mean? And it's I get the point with potentially young adults and children growing up with tech and maybe being normalised, but surely without turning it back into a political bashing, surely if you've had your fingers burnt several times because of this has been raised several times in the press, surely there must be measures in place to kind of prevent it from happening. Would you not have thought? I mean, it's that kind of it's like it's just that kind of missing mechanism internally to kind of prevent that from taking place.
Yeah, well, one would think so. One would think so. I mean, you know, if you're I get what you're saying, which is that at a certain point, listen, not to conflate what, you know, the Home Secretary's done here, because I think that is very much just a PR stunt, effectively, if nothing else. But, you know, you are right that it's been an issue that's been raised before in terms of how members of Parliament or, you know, just generally government officials communicate with one another, etc. But I think you're absolutely correct on the fact that at a certain point, if you've been stung before and you've consistently failed to correct that, that's the point where surely really serious questions have to be asked. And this is what I always say to customers, particularly when they get sort of panicky because a breach has happened and they're worried the ICO are going to get involved. I always say to them, you know, the ICO probably won't, most certainly won't come down on you unless what you are demonstrating is a consistent disregard for the rules or best practice, or you're, you know, actively dodging correcting something. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're genuinely sort of failing to correct things, then there's not really anything to worry about. But if you are, you know, not correcting that as you go along, if you're consistently having the same issues, the same breaches, whatever, that's when surely, yeah, as I say, serious probes have to, you know, serious questions have to be asked.
For sure. And around the ministers, again, it just highlights that they don't understand the law in the sense that we discussed their approach to spouting nonsense about the data protection laws, that kind of thing. But on the side, if they're still going to do it, and they've been advised not to do it, and they're still going to do it, and there's measures potentially in place that we're not aware of to prevent them doing it, and they're still going to do it, that kind of thing, doesn't it just further kind of drive a divide between them and us, as it's like happened with the COVID and all the parties and all that kind of stuff? It's all right for them, but you guys have got to do it this way, that kind of stuff. And again, it just doesn't really feel like the approach the government should be doing. I appreciate you, the comment is saying that it's a publicity stunt, and it maybe was, but I'm sure there's other stuff she could have done from a publicity stunt prior to resigning, as opposed to necessarily saying, oh, I've sent this by me private email, I shouldn't have, now I'm off, that kind of thing. I think if there wasn't some overriding objective, that would have just been swept under the carpet, like most stuff, I would have thought. And I think it's just, in essence, just shows a bit of a disregard to those laws of you, not necessarily for us approach.
Yeah, and it's interesting because not all, this doesn't go necessarily for the entire public sector, because we've seen, I don't know if you noticed this, but this week I think the police overall have now fully changed or made a significant change to their stance with investigating, you know, rape cases, particularly Ree Stafford's statement. So we spoke about this a couple of months ago, because the ICO put out some guidance, or put out an opinion rather, saying that they didn't agree, etc. It's disproportionate. And I believe now, literally in this last week, someone might have more information on this, but the police have now changed that. And now they've said, you know, we're not going to do these massive digital searches anymore. You know, we've taken on board the guidance, etc. So clearly, you know, it's not a public sector issue. on the whole, because that would be ludicrous to say there's a public sector issue on the whole. But you know what I'm getting at, which is that clearly, you know, that change can be brought. So what's the excuse for central government? I don't know.
No, for sure. But we still see that outside of government and kind of moving away from politics, we do see it occasionally within organisations where they're still using private email addresses to communicate with board members, for example, that kind of thing. So we still see examples of it, maybe not heavily, but there are some examples still out there where this kind of thing kind of happens and still occurs, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those things where you do feel like if an issue comes of it or a breach comes of it, it's sort of the thing where you're really sort of tearing your hair out because you go, this was so easy to avoid. There was no issue here. There was no risk. And all of a sudden you've created this problem. But it goes for, you know, not just the use of emails necessarily. You see it a lot also just in people using systems in ways they shouldn't. So interestingly, I think I can speak about this a little bit without saying too much either, but we had a really interesting case come in to our support desk over the past week, whereby within a housing provider, basically someone had accessed records about a property that a relative of theirs was considering purchasing, and had seen that there were neighbour disputes and issues with the quality of the property or the integrity of the property, and therefore had, you know, cancelled or urged their relative to cancel that viewing. And, you know, the person who was selling the property got in touch and said, well, this is a data breach. You know, clearly someone's got this information from somewhere and they shouldn't have had access to it, which is a really interesting conundrum because, first of all, is it a personal data breach? In my view, were controls breached? I don't know. If your access controls aren't right, that's not necessarily the same thing as a breach of security, but that's a separate issue. But you know, we went back and said, well, you might not have a personal data breach, but clearly you've got an issue with staff doing this because you shouldn't be able to just help yourself to information for your own purposes. There have to be acceptable use policies, and if you've breached them, there may be consequences to that. Have you ever seen anything like this, Dave?
Similar. I think kind of just going back a step, it helps to kind of understand the fact that the definition of a data breach is a two-part test, isn't it? One, you need a breach of security. So A, what is a breach and what does a breach mean? How has that affected the security? So was something bypassed? Was something circumvented? Was something not in place in the first place? That kind of thing from a security measure. And if you consider that under Article 32 for security of processing, you're talking technical and organizational measures, aren't you? You're not necessarily just talking a breach of technical standards. You've got technical and organizational measures, and has there potentially been a breach of technical organizational measures? So there you've got a security incident, but it must have some kind of negative consequence or impact on personal data, hasn't it? So you're looking at, has the information been destroyed? Is it lost? Has it been an unauthorized access or disclosed? That kind of thing. So it's a two-part test. You've got the first bit about the security, and the second bit, has there been an effect on personal data? And I've had it similar with a client that has asked my opinions on it, because information, a tenant has suggested that the information was shared with a contractor, and that was a breach of personal data in that sense. But the contractor was awarded by the organisation. It was appointed by the organisation, and they're entitled to have some information in that sense. And sometimes I think the crossover is with some individuals, I think, well, you need my consent to do anything with my data, and I didn't consent to this person having it in that sense. When you go through, was there a breach of security? Well, no, the organisation was appointed. The organisation had been through due diligence, had appropriate measures in place, and the controller was happy to work with that organisation. So there was no breach that led to that organisation having that information in that sense. So it's trying to break it down and have a look at what's going on. And I've seen it to that level. It's maybe not quite the same as the example that you gave. But I've certainly seen individuals and complaints where they feel that there's been a breach because somebody had their information that they didn't necessarily consent to.
Yeah, and I suppose this is, well, in that case, you know, you might have issues around, and this is where I think it's always difficult when you're trying to work with people who maybe, you know, haven't got necessarily the confidence around some of the terminology, and trying to explain that maybe you don't have a personal data breach on your hand, but what you might have is an issue with, in your case anyway, Dave, that you've explained there, an issue with transparency, because people aren't sufficiently aware or informed of the fact that, you know, their data was going to be shared. And that potentially could be the problem. Yeah, that's exactly what Emma's just saying.
For sure.
But yeah, that could be an issue there. Or maybe you've got issues with your acceptable use policies because staff are not aware that they should or should not be doing certain things. So this is where, you know, the value of having a really strong framework that people are trained on really sort of comes into its own, right?
Well, it is, because it comes down to not just training, isn't it? When you're looking at training, and I know we've covered this before as well, and I've probably bent your ear about it, but training not just being on data protection and information security, but training on the systems and training people about not just how to use the systems, but what not to do with the systems as well. In that sense, it may well be self-evident, but sometimes training must be self-evident so everybody's aware of it. But telling people what they can't do and why they can't do it, so you can't take information off the system for your own use. You know what I mean? Individuals maybe never actually sat there and considered that they couldn't. And I'm not saying it's a right approach or a wrong approach, but if they've never had appropriate training to that kind of basic level, saying, well, actually, you can't do this. You're not intended to do. You've only got access for this role and the role that you're permitted to do, and you can't do anything else outside of that. So I think it's not just kind of the basic GDPR. You've got your principles, you've got your risk assessments, you've got your ROPAs, and happy days, you've done it now, off you pop, and we'll see you in another 12 months. It's really making it relevant and being clear to people about their role, their responsibilities within that role, their access to the data within that role, and what they should and should not be doing with it.
Yeah, agreed. It's one of those things where, you know, it will take you such a long way to have really sort of, it's going beyond just training, right? It's going beyond just sort of listing off people's responsibilities and actually, you know, taking them with you on the journey and saying, you know, I need to make sure that you understand this and understand the, you know, the concepts behind it and the implications of your actions potentially. One of the things that I always liked about your training, Dave, is, you know, how much you talk about when we look at personal data, the fact that it's not just information. These are real people and real people's lives that you're dealing with. And if you're able to communicate that to staff in terms of, you know, understanding their responsibilities, again, takes you a really long way.
No, for sure. And like I say, it's a really valid point. It's one of those things, like you say, sometimes you wonder, and it's only my opinion, it's only come from me kind of just thinking about stuff and mulling bits over, but sometimes you wonder whether when you talk about data, are people just thinking about kind of bits of words on a paper or typed information onto an Excel sheet or something like that. Did they actually sit down and think, well, actually, it's what we're talking about is when we're talking about data protection, we're really talking about people protection, because we're talking about people and their rights and our impact upon that if we get it wrong in that kind of sense, or willfully get it wrong. And it's trying to have that kind of focus that we're all about trying to protect people and their rights in that sense, and just trying to bring it to life a little bit more. Because you often hear when you go into training, people going, oh, it's protection training, oh, it'll be boring, and it's such a dry subject. And it's just trying to find different ways to bring it all to life and make it relevant and understanding, relevant and interesting to people so that they understand it and get on board with it a bit better in that sense. So, you know, there's quite a lot of bits in there to kind of unpack and get right. But as you know, with the system side of things, we've often spoken about, and it comes from some examples I've had from the past where you kind of say, here's your username, there's your password, there's the CRM system. Whoever it is going to give you 10 minutes to kind of quickly show you around. And now you're trained and you kind of go, well, that's not training, is it? In that sense. And then you get this kind of break between somebody's comfort. Well, firstly, they've been taught by what in essence appears to be nothing more than a little bit of Chinese whispers, but then the individual gets a sense of confidence in the fact that they're now using the system. They might have been taught the right way, they might have been taught through Chinese whispers, or they may have been basically taught somebody else's bad habits in how to use the system, but they've got this level of confidence, which sometimes seems to be a kind of a disconnect with where their level of competence is. And when things go wrong and you start investigating from a root cause analysis, you often see there's a big gap between somebody's doing something because they thought that's how they should do it, as in confidence, and not necessarily the competence were, because they've never actually necessarily been shown, guided, or had appropriate measures around that to make sure that they were doing it in the correct manner.
No, absolutely. And it's such again, it's typically the type of incident where it's so easy to prevent that. You know, just taking the time to sit down with people, as you say, and work through these things with them. And it's the type of breach typically where, were it to happen, it makes the organisation look rather foolish. And yeah, it's easily avoided. I don't know how we got here from talking about the Home Secretary's resignation, but you know, that's the nature of these things, I suppose. We've got about 15 minutes left on this episode. There's a couple more bits I wanted to cover. We mentioned it a couple of weeks ago, but I thought it was worth coming back to. Now, I would like it stated here, particularly if the Chinese government are listening, I do not have a specific agenda against TikTok or its use. It's just, it's been in the news a lot recently, so I think it's worth talking about. Zara's giving me a smirk because she knows that I tend to take the mick out of her use of TikTok. Anyway, that's by the by. So the storm around this particular app continues. So we've spoken about it over the last couple of weeks. I say a couple of weeks back, we mentioned that the ICO had published an intention to fine them for £20 to £30 million, something to that effect, Dave, for allowing access to under 13s in unregulated fashion, something that we were aware of. But now the ICO say published that intention to fine. We'll see what comes of that. But there have been two more news stories this week, which are slightly less privacy related, but I think were interesting, just sort of to build the bigger picture of what's happening behind the scenes here. I don't know if you saw either of these stories, Dave. You will have seen the one about the ICO's intention to fine, I assume.
I saw the one about the intention to fine. I've just not necessarily dug into this one as far as I could have on the matters, but we'll kick it around and see what we get with it.
Well, no worries. Well, the first one is a story that I read last week, which is pretty appalling, but, you know, worth raising, which is that apparently there's a, I don't want to call it a trend, but a, you know, well, let's call it a trend that happens on the app whereby effectively people from refugee camps will live stream themselves basically begging for donations because they're people in extreme poverty in very difficult situations, and it's a way for them to communicate very quickly with the wider world. And it's something that they were doing, including, you know, children, etc. However, it transpired.
Are they doing it for themselves or as part of a campaign to support a particular charity then? Just so I understand the...
No, like directly, individuals directly.
Oh, one and one
for,
asking. Oh, I see. Okay.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Which is why I use the word begging specifically, because it is.
Oh, as opposed to kind of asking for a donation. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So it's literally individuals like, we are here, we need money, etc. And, but it came out in a report last week, I think, 10 days ago, that those donations weren't going directly to those individuals live streaming. Shock, horror. Turns out that they weren't getting the full amount. Not only were they not getting the full amount, TikTok was helping themselves to up to 70% of the donations made by users. Donations which in some cases, according to this report, I'm not making this up, could you know, spiral up to $1,000 an hour. So effectively, jeez, TikTok were making at various points $700 an hour off the back of these people in refugee camps and begging for money. I mean, I can only giggle because it's so atrocious. I mean, how catastrophically awful. It doesn't matter what way you slice it. It is not a good look. And do you know how they've responded to this? They've just banned children from live streaming on the platform. There you go. See you later. That's it. We've washed our hands of it. So that's the first story. That's prepared you for that. I just thought it was worth reading.
Yeah,
because...
it's interesting. I mean, it's harrowing, to be fair. But it's interesting when you start looking at things like whether there should be and it's only kind of kicking around, whether there should be some kind of ethics regulator around platforms like this. When you kind of go, well, ethically that's not right, is if you've got somebody in such destitute, then an organization, if they're going to promote that to try and help them, let's say put it in a bit of a positive, like they're doing it to try and help them, that should they not be doing it where they're not making anything? If they're going to do it, it's that cost only. They're not doing it for a profiteering point, because the money should really be going to where the help's needed the most in that sense. And whether there should be any kind of regulated ethical platform or ethical kind of standard where this can't be allowed to happen, because it's just profiteering off those who shouldn't be profiteered from because of how destitute they are.
Well, precisely. And it's interesting because it's a good point you raise it in the context of something that's gone quiet recently, but there was an awful lot of noise about it up until just recently, which was the online harms bill. I don't know where that's ended up, but that's in a similar vein, talking about, you know, the ethics of social media platforms in particular, and these sort of online giants. But that, I don't know if anyone's got any information on that, but as far as I'm aware, that's gone pretty quiet. But in that similar vein, you're right. You know, are we able to institute some level of oversight of this type of thing? And because at the end of the day, the technology itself is just a platform, right? But it's human designed. And if there are people who are going to be able to make a buck out of it, then they're going to do that. And which is, you know, a pretty damning indictment, but that's the way it is. So are you able, as you say, Dave, to institute some kind of oversight? In this case, we're talking about a Chinese company. So are you, would you even be able to do that as, you know, someone in the UK? Who knows? It's just an additional complication to what is already a complex scenario.
But it appears, doesn't it, when we have the issue with Facebook and the continuing issues with Facebook, Meta, that kind of thing, that are some of these tech companies that big that they're above everything else, that they can continue to do this kind of thing as it's, well, it's all right until we get caught. There's no kind of filtering, kind of an internal filter saying, well, actually, this isn't really ethical. Is it? If we're going to help or do something to support these individuals, then there ought to be some kind of corporate social responsibility to ethics or to human rights and that kind of thing, and not necessarily just to use it as a profiteering model to, because in essence, it's kind of nearly like fraud, isn't it? Because you're getting somebody who's donating to a cause that you then not transparently in any way, well, it doesn't appear to be transparently, kind of then filtering off most of it for themselves. You know what I mean? And it's I just think it's,
yeah,
I just think it's wrong, and it's just TikTok, Facebook, that kind of thing. I just think they give the impression that because they're a large global organization that they're above everything else.
I think it has to be presumably one of two things. Either there are people trying to do the right thing and saying the right things, but they're being overruled by more senior members of staff, or people are just turning a blind eye, which, you know, there are histories of, in or a bit of both, as you rightly say. So who knows? I mean, the latest story, so I said it's sort of a three-parter on TikTok. The latest one is that there's a report from Forbes from this week which alleges that, and I say this is all allegations at present, it's been refuted by the company, but that basically a splinter team of researchers from TikTok's parent company are working on tracking the movements and locations of users in the US. Now, this has been very sort of aggressively denied by the company. Forbes, however, have stood firm and said they believe their sources, they think they're solid. But if so, and if they genuinely have people working in the background on tracking user location and movements in, well, a foreign country effectively, you know, in the US, that's quite substantial. For something which is meant to be an app where you record yourself doing dances, I mean, that's pretty dystopian.
I think it's working by picking up on the kind of the geolocation tech within the phone and kind of just reading that information.
Well, one would assume so, because one would assume that it's accessible. It's just whether they are actually doing it or not. I mean, the data's there. Geolocation, you know, your phone will do that, but it's whether it's actually in use. Listen, I don't know. At the minute, it's a very sort of early story. There's not much coming out of it. I say it's being argued by the two sides, but it's pretty frightening. And in the context of the two stories we've just discussed, I mean, it doesn't paint them in a very good light, does it?
No, it doesn't really. And all that tech kind of company, where things are going with the tech point. I know we've not spoken about it, but I know we've spoken off air previously about it, and we've never had chance to kind of kick it around a bit. But it comes back to, you remember I shared that report? I'm not sure if I did share the report. If I haven't, I will do. On neurotechnology.
You've been meaning to talk about this for weeks.
Yeah.
Tell us all about it. You've got 5 minutes.
And there's a report out, or a kind of a government report on neurotechnology law and the legal profession. If anybody's interested, I'll circulate it around. But the report was produced by Dr. McKay, who is the deputy director of the Sydney Institute of Criminology, and is also an academic fellow at the University of Sydney Law School. And it's a really, really interesting read around neurotechnology in bits and pieces. Now, it may sound slightly kind of sci-fi to start with, but neurotechnology is being kind of technology that you can either have implanted or either wearable technology that interacts with your brain, in essence, and brainwaves and that kind of stuff. And it's going to have and potentially have a big impact in law in the coming years and a big impact in society in the coming years. Now, there's lots of opportunities in neurotechnology. I'm not trying to say it shouldn't be looked at and we need to kind of stay away with it, but there's huge privacy concerns with it. But in essence, there are forms of neurotechnology to kind of help, or that may be able to help with health conditions. So you imagine things like Parkinson's, possibly depression, and being able to offer some form of therapeutic support for that through a better kit that interacts and works better with or kind of interacts with your brain to give you some kind of form of relief from the conditions that you're suffering from. But there's potential for non-therapeutic advantages as well. If you start thinking about enhancing cognitive abilities through the use of tech and making you think quicker or react quicker in that sense, then it could give you some kind of benefits or put you at an advantage over those who don't have it. In that sense, if you could think quicker, react quicker, and bits and pieces, then you could start thinking about, and the report does go into areas around using neurotechnology in corporate workplaces, in police, in the military and things like that. So do go and have a read of it. But it's really interesting from that point and where it may be going. But the threats that they do kind of talk about within that report as well is the threats to your individual ability to make your own decisions, because if you're interacting and influencing brainwaves through a computer device or some form of interface, that may make you behave or influenced by particular biases. Then it kind of gets to this kind of, if you've done something, not the argument a while back about driverless cars, if you have an accident in a driverless car, is it the car or is it you? That kind of thing. But if you've got neurotechnology going on and you're wearing this device or you've got something implanted, then again, if you're responding because the tech's making you respond in a particular way, then are you necessarily in control of your responses? Through those kinds of things. And then it highlights things like, well, what about your private thoughts? What about your privacy around, or does
just
privacy...
lost you there, Dave. I think your Sorry. Implants might have switched off.
It's Elon Musk has got hold of me again. But when you're looking at neurotech and whether privacy laws are suitable as they currently stand, or whether you maybe need some form of mental privacy laws to protect mental cognition and bits and pieces, do go and have a look. I thought it was absolutely fascinating read to kind of go through it and start looking at bits and pieces around neurotechnology. And it's like, so if you want it sharing, I'm more than happy to share it. Or we can maybe, Miles could link to it when he puts this bit on the website and so on. And so forth.
Yeah,
but it's a really, really interesting development. Well, say development. Really interesting in the development of where law and tech may be going in the future.
Well, also, I mean, the point to raise, and I know that there's, you know, certain popular media that have sort of touched on this previously, but if you are opening up if you're basically eroding the boundaries between tech and, as you say, the mind, etc. You're getting yourself into a position where, in theory, that then becomes hackable. And from a cybersecurity point of view, all of a sudden, you're working with a very different environment and a much, much higher stakes, one would think. If you're talking about, in theory, as you say, like implants or whatever that are hackable. I mean, it sounds science fiction, but you're right. It's getting ever closer.
You're absolutely right with cyber hacks and cyber attacks and manipulating people into particular courses of action that they may not have necessarily intended had they been operating under their own direction, shall we say. But in addition to that, you've also got the bits that we were looking at previously around AI and things around algorithmic biases. And that's all surely going to come into account if you're looking at tech or interacting with tech through your mind and being able to switch on lights, answer the phone, and understand bits at a greater speed and a greater level and that kind of thing. Well, are you going to then be subject to particular biases within the way the machine's built or the way the device is meant to be interacting and sending influences to your mind, really?
Yeah, that is interesting. That is interesting. I mean, I saw a news story this morning which was saying that, I don't know if you follow this, this is really sort of off topic, but we're closing out the session anyway. One of the things that I saw, which was a report saying that one of the latest trends on the internet is people getting AI to create art. So So you basically give specific AI prompts and they go off and make art for you. But this report was saying that it has a clearly, all of this art being produced has such a distinctly European influence that it's sort of smothering any other artistic influences from anywhere else. And obviously that's because AI is trained, right? And it's trained using whatever you give it. So you're right, in terms of biases, all of a sudden it puts you in a very interesting position. And we've spoken at length on previous episodes about the impact of artificial intelligence depending on how it is trained and any biases it may have and the real world consequences of that, because they are increasingly ever more present as this sort of technology creeps into our lives. I don't want you to bring up what's your favorite film?
I'm not going to mention it.
No, go on, it's the last episode. What's that film?
The Minority Report,
that's the one. But yeah, I know how much you like that. Well, I'll tell you what, on that note, we've gone off on some thoroughly odd, potentially, tangents, but it's fitting, really, because that's the format. Anything else you want to raise, Dave? We're pretty much closing out now.
Yeah, it's just there. I've put the link to the Neurotech report that was just referred to in the chat. So if anybody's kind of wants to open a chat and see the link, you can download it there. It's on the lawsociety.org.uk website under research. But the full link's there. Should take you to the document on that one. The only last thing for me is I thought it was a great session to end your end session on, Ollie. So thank you very much for your time. I've really appreciated being able to sometimes sound like we know what we're talking about, sometimes do a little bit of political bashing, and sometimes share the soapbox as well. So it's been an absolute pleasure, and hopefully we'll maybe have you back on as a guest speaker at some point, or we'll branch out and we'll do this on the side on an evening rather than through the main core part, working part of the day.
Yeah, we'll I'm sure we'll come to something, but thanks, Dave, it means a lot. Very much enjoyed all of this, as I'm sure you all know. There's a reason that we do it every week, is because we enjoy it so much. Thanks to everyone who's ever attended, really, because it wouldn't be possible without any of you. Our community that has grown quite incredibly over the last couple of years. It's really quite extraordinary. So, yes, that's the end for me, but certainly not for the podcast. It'll be back next week, won't it, Dave? You'll be cracking on without me. Same time, same place. I am not entirely certain what next week's session is, producer Miles, just in a sort of that's how things normally work around here. I'm not entirely sure what the next session is.
Actually the first time in I think about 2 years we don't have a discussion for next week. We had to move a few things around with availability issues and stuff like that, so we've actually got a free open week next week, so we may have a week off, or we may have another episode of GDPR radio, but invites will be out on Monday if that is the case.
Well, there you go, Dave, it's your opportunity to really sort of take the reins on this one.
Or hand them over to Zara, which may be what's the topic of next week's session. All I would add to that, if anybody's got anything really interesting or any points that you'd like us to talk about, if you can get them to Miles before Monday, we'll certainly consider them in with a view to next Friday's episode.
Absolutely. And so on that note, that's it from me. Thanks all once again. And I look forward to eventually catching up with you all on future episodes of GDPR Radio. Take care, Dave.
Take care. All the best.
Cheers, all.